This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Julian Ng. On the Breakfast Grill today is Tony Pua, Political Secretary to the Minister of Finance and also MP for Damansara. Tony, good morning, welcome to the show.
Morning.
Now, let's start with some reflection. You were not voted into the Selangor State Committee in the Selangor State Ordinary Convention in 2018. Now, your contributions to the nation and to the party as well can't be denied. You were a key agent in exposing 1MDB and educating the public to it. Have you had some closure as to what led to your ouster?
I think the reason is obvious. I have led DAP Selangor, and I have made decisions which perhaps were not into my own personal political interests, but perhaps were in the interests of DAP at large and Malaysia as a whole. It has been well documented that I have made it one of my key efforts to bring in new blood, professional, young politicians who I believe have a long way to go in helping grow this country. And perhaps since the elections, I haven't spent enough time on the ground, meeting up with the grassroots, keeping them abreast of affairs. And as a result, some segments who are not happy with my leadership with regards to perhaps candidature or other things had the opportunity to go around and campaign against me. So I accept that as the cause of the work that I do.
I mean, this also has implications on the leadership of DAP, because if a meritocratic person such as yourself can't maintain a leadership role. And all those reasons are kind of well documented, right? Yeah. Your management style has been said to be quite aloof and isolated, some of the grassroots. But what does this mean for the future of DAP if a leader such as yourself can't maintain a position?
I think the important point is that's just the Selangor State Committee. That is not the national leadership. That is not my position in government, in assisting the new government as well as to assist the party in the new government. There are many ways to contribute, and that's merely one of the many, many channels available. Mm-hmm. So definitely, it is a bruise on the ego, no doubt about it, but it has little or no implications with regards to how I will serve both the party and country.
And I promise you that I'll move away from the focus on you and to other issues. But were you disappointed not being selected for a ministerial position because of your contribution?
No. Actually, it was my specific request to the party not to put my name on the list of ministers and deputy ministers. So every party submits a list to the prime minister for consideration. And I have made it, due to various reasons, I've put in a request not to be in that list.
And why is that? Why didn't you want to be a minister or even a deputy?
Main reason, there are a few reasons, but main reason being, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to assist in the Ministry of Finance. It's a huge, huge, huge ministry. And it's not a ministerial position where whoever who holds the post can afford to fail. It is very important for Lim Guan Eng as the finance minister to succeed, important both for the country, finances, for the party to prove that we can do it, as well as for national integration, something that is not perhaps looked at closely. We need to build that trust between races, and it is important to show that even though it is a Chinese finance minister, Malays who are in need of support, Indians who are in need of support, will benefit as a result of good governance and good policies. Mm-hmm. And this is an opportunity of a lifetime, something that if we fail this time, we may not get again in centuries to come. So it's to me, very, very important in finance ministry for the finance minister to succeed. And I thought that given my background, my inclination, my dispensation, I would be better served as whatever position that I'm given to assist the minister in the MOF.
Okay, we wanted to talk about that further, but just still on the DAP elections, it's clear that the grassroots have made a stamp with their voices. And this may be good or bad, because if the grassroots become stronger, then it may result in a more DAP would have a more sectarian voice rather than focusing on the national issue. And then at the same time, DAP is also perceived as a Chinese party. Will DAP be able to shed this image? And will DAP be able to deal with the PH coalition partners in a comfortable manner?
I think the angst from the delegates of the last Selangor elections were pretty much directed at me, and pretty much only at me and a few who might have been associated with me. Most of the other leaders were voted in without too much of a problem. We have Gobind Singh as the chairman, someone that I support completely. It was my intent even before the last general elections to actually hand over the leadership to him anyway. And hence the position of the party hasn't changed. And it is our job to convince the grassroots that we should get ourselves back on track, to focus on the national issues, to focus on governance, and to prove that DAP would have staying power in government.
The image of DAP being a more multiracial party has been a few decades in the making, right? It's still, from the viewpoint of public, pretty unconvincing at the moment. I mean, you've taken in a few star Malay members, but still you needed to be in a coalition that consisted of other Malay partners.
Absolutely. And we don't deny that. It's a work in progress. It's a very difficult work in progress. Let me give an example. For a young Malay aspiring politician, who does he join in order to get better traction with community? The easy way out is to join either Bersatu, Amanah, or even PKR. Perhaps even PAS and UMNO. The last thing that an aspiring young Malay politician will consider is to join DAP. So while we want them to join DAP, it doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't other opportunities for them to join. So it is an uphill battle. It's something that we're working on, something that we are gaining traction, but it will take time. And to prove the point that the elections last round wasn't about a Chinese rebellion or anything of that sort, we do have Gobind Singh as the chairman of DAP Selangor.
Okay, it's the DAP election internal machinery in need of some kind of reform, because it's still based on a delegate system, right, which is vulnerable to patronage. Should you adopt a one-person, one-vote mechanism like PKR? And even, in the Labour Party in the UK, they have gone through many rounds of very painful reforms to bring about new leaders and fresh ideas.
To be honest, I'm not sure if such a system would have brought a different result in the last DAP elections. That's number one. Number two, our system is actually a lot more democratic, as in grassroots democratic, than, say, the other political parties. Our systems are based on branches, which means that the lowest unit of the organisation. For most of the other parties, they are based on divisions, which means that the branches vote delegates into division then send delegates to the central body. So ours are based on branches. And we are the only political party that holds elections at the state level. Almost, every other political party appoints state leadership. Mm-hmm. We are the only political party that actually holds elections at the state level.
So Lim Kin Siang and Lim Guan Eng have been around for a long time. Of course, doing great service to the nation and to the party, no doubt. But many critics call it a dynasty. And you yourself had a meteoric rise, but you seem to be out of the leadership picture right now.
Why am I out of leadership? I'm in the National Central Executive Committee. I'm the National Publicity Secretary. Some may have forgotten that. And I play a big role in the decisions of the party as a whole.
Do you think that DAP has enough content of fresh blood and fresh ideas? When would we see some of these new young blood rising up to the leadership level?
I think if you look at
level?
The national composition of the national leadership, the Central Executive Committee, we have the highest number of leaders who are under the age of 40. We have the most number of MPs under the age of 40. So I think we are the most progressive in our drive to actually bring younger leaders into the party. So we are very balanced. Of course, we have senior leaders like Lim Kit Siang, who provides us the moral compass in going forward. He doesn't hold an official position in the party. He doesn't even want to be the parliamentary head of the party. He doesn't want to be in the cabinet. And that shows that he only wants to serve the nation, and he only wants to steer the party forward and let the younger leaders take charge.
We are speaking to Tony Pua, political secretary to the Minister of Finance as well as MP for Damansara. We'll be back with more. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Tony Pua, political secretary to the Minister of Finance and MP for Damansara, is on the Breakfast Grill this morning. Tony, let's look into Pakatan Harapan's performance so far. I mean, it's... DAP and the other members of Pakatan did the unthinkable of overturning almost more than half a century of UMNO BN rule. There has been some hits, there has been some misses. Overall, there is still this feeling of uneasiness in the atmosphere. You earlier on talked about the importance of racial harmony and you wanted a key role in that. There is still a very palpable racial and religious strife in the country. Is this something that the coalition partners can talk out easily?
It's not easy because it has been ingrained in our society for the longest time. And the easiest way for the opposition at this point in time to get back in to attack the current government is to continue the racial and religious angles. And there's no better way than to attack the boogeyman DAP in government. And you can see that it is a very concerted effort by both UMNO and PAS to focus their entire ammunition on the DAP. They attribute all sorts of things that are wrong or not wrong, but painted as wrong, to the DAP, to the Ministry of Finance, regardless of whether it has anything to do with the DAP or the Ministry of Finance.
So that is a manifestation, if one can make some kind of conclusion, that it's a very tough relationship to actually work out some explicit policy on racial harmony, isn't it?
It is tough. And it's not just about a policy. It's about facing the challenges in the political landscape. Our leaders in Pakatan Harapan should perhaps be braver in defending racial diversity, racial unity. We need to change the narrative. I think the narrative is straying a little bit for fear, understandable fear of perhaps losing the Malay vote. But we need to remember that the same strategy was used by BN and PAS in the last general election, race and religion, and they failed to win the votes of the people of this country. Hence, we should not get too distracted with their continued focus on race and religion.
Because I think they're also capitalizing on the fact that most of the Malay votes went to UMNO and BN as well, right?
And, that's right.
And a lot of the non-Malays voted the
approach,
for the other side.
The approach that we need to take is to show these voters who may have voted for BN and UMNO or even PAS that with good governance, with good policies, they benefit more than parties who just talk and harp on race and religion.
Now, the election promises have also been left hanging in the balance, if not abandoned. I mean, on toll roads, you did some pretty neat videos before
why,
election.
Why is it abandoned? Who said it was abandoned?
Well, it's just a general feeling that
we
a lot of these election promises can't be fulfilled. Yeah.
We have brought in a lot of changes. Many of the promises have already been fulfilled. If not entirely fulfilled, fulfilled in certain modified versions due to the reality of the circumstances. There are outstanding promises to be fulfilled, and many of them are actually work in progress. But it's very difficult for a government to go out there, say, for example, toll roads, and immediately say, yep, we are going to do it, without telling you how we are going to do it. And that will only create confusion, disruption in the markets, and that's extremely irresponsible for us to do. So, of course, we will be attacked for now. But if and when the promises get fulfilled, then we believe that the attacks will diminish.
I think if one wanted to link this problematic relationship, one can sort of make the perhaps fair or unfair conclusion that this is linked to the dominance of PPBM in the alliance, right? Because this is a party that has won the least seats in the coalition, but is still very dominant in the government and in influence. And this is making policymaking very precarious. For example,
That's not fair. That's not fair because whether we like it or not, we have Tun Dr. Mahathir as a prime minister of this country. And naturally, as the prime minister, you would be dominant. It would be quite worrying if the prime minister isn't dominant in the cabinet. That said, I would just like to emphasize that many of the policies that government is doing actually goes through extensive discussion in the cabinet, negotiations among the leaders. And to be very, very fair, to PPBM and to the Prime Minister, he has very often conceded to the views of the majority of the cabinet. I think that's one thing we are particularly happy with in this government. It's not quite seen among the public because discussions in cabinet are confidential. But I'm happy because decisions are not arrived at arbitrarily. Decisions are not arrived at based on whims and fancies of any particular leader. But pretty much decisions, right or wrong, were arrived at as a matter of consensus.
The transfer of GLCs and the sovereign wealth fund like Petronas, Khazanah, PNB from the Ministry of Finance under your boss Lim Guan Eng to the Economic Affairs Ministry under Dato' Sri Azmin Ali.
It's not transferred to Economic Affairs Ministry.
That's
again another misconception that is well spread out there. It's transferred to the Prime Minister's Department.
Okay, and these assets are worth 1 trillion. But coming back to the question of this idea of an economic affairs ministry, and just to get some clarification from you, what do you see as the segregation of duties between economic affairs and MOF? And these assets were formerly under the MOF, right? 1 trillion worth of assets now, as you say, transferred to the PM.
Petronas has always sat with the Prime Minister. PNB has always sat with the Prime Minister. The only real entity that was actually transferred to the Prime Minister under the new administration is Khazanah. Several entities have been transferred to MEA, Ministry of Economic Affairs. That includes Tabung Haji, that includes several other entities such as Equinas and so on. Now, the underlying principle is the Economic Affairs Ministry isn't a new entity. It is merely a corporatized unit of the Economic Planning Unit in the past. So it is an existing unit. It's not like built from scratch, created just for one particular minister. It wasn't. Number two, there is a degree, and we must accept that, of sensitivity. When you have the first Chinese finance minister in the 44 years. And given the sentiments out there, to manage that transition, it is only proper for certain entities like Tabung Haji to be shifted to Ministry of Economic Affairs. It's just pure practical thing. And this is something that Lim Guan Eng, the finance minister, has no problems with. You know, there's enough things for the Ministry of Finance to manage within its books at the moment to quibble over several entities that were being transferred to the Prime Minister's Department or the MEA.
Now, many observers are also saying that there are unseen hands at work to cement political hegemony. Daim is very prominent, a non-government member, having key role in the disbanded Council of Eminent Persons, and still very visible today, making statements on the government, on behalf of the government. Are you worried that we'll return to an era of cronyism that we saw in the 90s, right, with the infamous Daim boys? DAP had been very vociferous about this in the past.
As long as we don't see organisations, entities starting to clamour for directly negotiated projects with the Ministry of Finance, with our procurement department, then those cronistic practices will not return.
Well, it's very worrying if you see some of the voices coming out of PPBM that a project's got to be handed out. And all these projects that are being announced, right? Third National Car.
Absolutely. There are remnants of that because many of them came from the UMNO background. But the point is, those are the voices from the grassroots of a particular party. The point to note is that that hasn't been the practice in this government.
Isn't the association...
In fact, we are doing the reverse. We are actually trying to institutionalize procurement processes by putting up a government procurement act where it actually criminalizes anyone who breaches procurement processes, including the need for open tenders, transparencies, in the guidelines of the Ministry of Finance.
I mean, if you talk about the Third National Car Project, for example, you know, there'll be not many takers and one or two would come forward. And that would lead to blurred lines, right? Because you don't have, you know, the idea here is just guilt by association and also with Daim, for example, and also policy.
I don't think Daim is supporting the Third National Car, or Daim is, or rather the better phrase to use is, I don't think Daim is involved in the Third National Car. So it's very unfair to link him to projects such as that. But that being said, the Third National Car, I think this has been emphasized by the Minister of Finance many, many times, doesn't involve the government building a new car.
Now, you're a technocrat, and DAP also has the CAT policy, competency, accountability and transparency. The appointment of the Economic Action Council, does that give an impression that the current crop of ministers not having the correct calibre? Why do you need the EAC, overseeing?
So it becomes a bit difficult for us when, if we were not to consult industry leaders, knowledge leaders, we are seen as trying to do everything ourselves. But when we set up a new council to involve some of the top thinkers like Professor Jomo, several other industry leaders to be in the council, to provide a sounding board, provide feedback, we get criticized for having a useless cabinet because they can't think and they need to rely on someone else. So it's a no-win situation. The decision that is made by the government has to be based on what is in the best interest of the country. And if in the best interest of the country is we get a NEAC, National Economic Action Council, to assist in crafting certain economic direction and policies for the government, to assist the cabinet making the final decision, then I think it is great for the country.
We're speaking to Tony Pua, political secretary to the Minister of Finance as well as MP of Damansara. We'll be back with more discussion after this. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Tony Pua, political secretary to the Minister of Finance as well as MP for Damansara. Now, the government recently introduced the My Salam scheme, which is a healthcare scheme for the B40 grouping. And in this vein, the government has done a deal with Great Eastern Life, which is absolved from selling its 30% stake in exchange for contributing 2 billion ringgit to the My Salam scheme. Among the features, each critical illness patient will get an 8,000 ringgit payout. Now, Tony, just bear with me right now because I want to clarify on an issue of technicality. Right now, there is a big chunk of the funds that are taken up by premium payments, albeit a non-profit payment. And this results in a lower average payout per claimant. Can we free up more funds by not paying these premiums and just use the 2 billion contribution just to pay out critical illnesses cost as is?
I don't understand your question. So I don't think your question makes sense.
Two billion ringgit is not a small sum of money, right? So let's say Malaysian has 6,000 deaths a year. Not all of them are CI, but let's say a quarter of that, 1,500 cases. The 2 billion, if you divided it by the amount of critical illness cases a year, it actually results in a lot of average payout per person, because right now about I think if I'm not wrong, 113 ringgit or thereabout is spent on paying premiums, right? So if you can
what are paying premiums for?
I don't know. You tell me.
Premiums are made to be paid by on average for every person, so that the payouts then comes from the premiums. So it's exactly what you're saying. So there's nothing wrong with paying premiums. So when you pay insurance premiums, is that you pay, say, 100 or 112 ringgit per person. And then you calculate based on these premiums, the risk profile, the average number of people who will get critical illness, and that premium base will actually do the claims payout for the people who suffer. So the deal that we have is actually very simple. The premiums paid are only for two reasons. Number one, payout. Whoever who gets critical illness. Number two, there is administrative.
There's a limitation of 8,000, right?
There's a limitation of 8,000.
So 2 billion divided by 6,000, let's say 6,000 deaths, right? And that's a very...
It's not deaths, critical illness.
Yeah, I know, but I'm taking the death number.
Why take the death number?
Because this the most objective indication...
A person who gets critical illness include kidney dialysis, kidney failure, he doesn't die.
So how have we done the calculations of how many...
Of course we have. We have Bank Negara...
How many CI patients would that be a year?
I don't have the number, but it works out such that the 112, and this is the insurance actuarial number where they measure the risk and the probability of people getting critical illness, and the payout. So that should balance out to a non-profit figure. Now, the arrangement we have done with the insurer or whoever who participates in this scheme, because it's not going to be GE alone. In future, there are more insurance companies joining the scheme. The arrangement we have done is that in the event the premiums that were paid to the insurance company exceeds the total claims from the patients, so there's a balance. That balance goes back to the fund. So what's the difference between what you are saying and paying of these premiums?
I'm just saying that certain calculations, like if I don't have the benefit of the number of CI patients a year.
So I think there needs to be a benefit of the doubt given to Bank Negara Malaysia, who does the actual studies. They have an insurance division. They look at the actual studies. They look at the probabilities of people getting various critical illness. They get the price of premium that is non-profit. And we have even worked the backup, the insurance to the insurance.
I understand that.
If we overpay, regardless, after our calculations, less claims than expected, that excess goes back to the fund.
My point is that if you use the 2 billion to pay out illnesses directly, you can pay more. For example, 50,000, 100,000 per person, because you're not carving out money to
pay premiums. You can't, because your numbers are the number of people getting sick, whether using your method or the insurance method, is the same. So you can't be paying more.
There has been some concerns and pushback, for example, suggested by PSM, whereby, among other things, they are suggesting that this 2 billion goes into the government budget instead of being carved out to...
It is in the government budget.
To fund the health bill directly so that you can get a higher payout per person. Also, the private sector in the insurance company has a form of risk rating.
I object to that very simply because the maths don't make sense. The maths just don't make sense. You're telling me 1 plus 1 equals 3, which is wrong. The premiums are made to make payouts, unless you're telling us that we are making fake payouts, which we are not going to. I mean,
we're trying to get a clarification on how this 2 billion can be stretched.
Someone who gets critical illness
because 8,000 is not...
Someone who gets critical illness gets 8,000.
Yeah.
Okay? So he doesn't get critical illness, he doesn't get 8,000.
It's not a
lot
of...
And based on the calculations, actuarial studies by both GE and Bank Negara, okay, the number of people getting critical illness, your 8,000 will finish in 5 years.
That's correct.
For 2 billion.
Yeah.
So that's the number of people
average cost of funding a critical illness treatment?
It varies. It varies from anything from 5,000 to 20,000. It depends on the illness that you have, depends on the number of treatments you get in government hospitals.
So how does the government make a decision to emphasize one critical illness over another?
Because it doesn't.
Cancer chemotherapy treatment is very expensive.
That's the way insurance packages work. You don't go to an insurance agency and buy a custom package tailored to yourself. You buy an insurance package based on 36 critical illness. So that is the standard industry formula. We didn't try and create any new formula from there.
Okay, can we just get some other clarification? Now, on the ECRL project, this has been an off-again, on-again project. Where do we stand now on this? Because 80 billion ringgit in terms of cost, and on the sidelines, there is also a pressure from the dominance of China in not cancelling this project.
I think I probably am not allowed to talk much about ECRL. You would have read in the papers today that Tun Daim, who is given the role to lead the negotiations, have stated that senior officials from the Chinese government are arriving next week for further discussions on the ECRL project. And we are hopeful that we can finally put closure to this project and move on. I think the relationship with China has never been better since we have taken over the government. The number of times my minister meet the ambassador is very, very frequent. And this bodes well for growth, trade and commerce between both countries. We just need to resolve ECRL, which I believe can be resolved, and we would be able to move forward in our relationship.
There were some suggestions in the press, not necessarily from government sources, panda bonds and samurai bonds will be issued, and a lot of overtures being made by China, not least that song that they created for us, right? So they're taking great pains to endear themselves to us.
That's right.
But just on the issue of the bonds, what is the policy on foreign bonds? Because while the interest rates are maybe more preferential, there could be FX risks.
There will always be FX risks from any foreign bonds. And that's why if we were to take foreign currency bonds, we should take a basket of currencies to mitigate the risk. So two aspects to it. Number one, the foreign currency borrowings remains a minute proportion of the total Malaysian government borrowings. So it will stay that way, whatever amount that we borrow. And number two, even within that minute proportion of borrowings that we have, it should be diversified between currencies, US dollars, Japanese yen, and so on. Now, we don't need to borrow overseas. There's sufficient liquidity locally. But borrowing overseas gives us the added advantage of being able to expose Malaysia to foreign investors. The recent trip I made together with the finance minister to Japan, for example, to meet bond-holding investors, we managed to meet many, many investors, and we managed to pitch Malaysia's story to many of them. So while the bonds is just one aspect of the investments, what we hope to do is also by being in front of these investors, they would look at other investments in Malaysia as well. So that applies not just to the Samurai bond, that would apply to if we were to take the Panda bond, if we were to borrow from US or if we were to borrow from Europe. But they will be in minute digestible portions that doesn't pose any fiscal risk to our balance sheet, and they will be balanced so that we would have our foreign exchange hedged.
Tony Pua, thank you so much for joining us, and wish you all the best in your efforts in this era of New Malaysia.
Thank you.
That was Tony Pua, Political Secretary to the Minister of Finance and MP of Damansara, joining us this morning on The Breakfast Grill. I'm Julian Ng, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Now with wider 4G LTE reach. Baru la best.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.